Welcome to New Game Plus. You are listening to a retro gaming podcast where three guys spend 7 days playing one old game and then we talk about it. My name's Dustin.
My name's Kenny.
I'm Nolan.
And this, once again, is Elements, which is our monthly bonus serialized series.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Wow.
I like it.
That was a little repetitive.
That is made completely possible by our patrons. Those are our loyal supporters that support us not only through listening to this podcast, but by their monthly donation to our cause and what we're doing. And this series is a reward for us meeting a certain goal on that Patreon page. So patreon.com/NGP podcast contains more information about that, how you could get involved with that process, how you can show the show support, and how you can get some additional content on a regular basis.
And at $500 of support a month,
yeah,
from our patrons,
right?
We are going to untie Dustin's tongue.
That's not what we're doing, but I think it is the $500 mark where we all sit down and play a D&D campaign together.
Yeah, I never agreed to that. I read that recently, and I was like,
Dustin added that just because it's on his bucket list.
I was like, hang on.
Don't worry, we're never going to get there, but still.
Elements is a detour from our normal episodes where we take a game and then we discuss a specific element of that game. Those elements include gameplay, characters, music, story, and
graphics.
Why do I
graphics.
Say this every time? Graphics. So it could be a notable game where it's popular for graphics, and we talk about why those graphics are great. Whatever it is, we're going to deep dive into that discussion and talk about it.
For our sixth Elements episode, we are going to talk about a series of first-person shooter games that had its first release in 2007 and its latest release in 2013. And these games have some of the best graphics, the best music, characters, definitely world building, really of all time. However, in this episode, we are going to discuss one particular element that stands out above all the rest, and that is the story of BioShock.
I am Andrew Ryan. And I'm here to ask you a question. Is a man not entitled to the sweat of his brow? No, says the man in Washington, it belongs to the poor. No, says the man in the Vatican, it belongs to God. No, says the man in Moscow, it belongs to everyone. I rejected those answers. Instead, I chose something different. I chose the impossible. I chose rapture. A city where the artist would not fear the censor, where the scientist would not be bound by petty morality, where the great would not be constrained by the small. And with the sweat of your brow, rapture can become your city as well.
So the story of BioShock is really long and really detailed.
Really,
and we're definitely
really
going
long.
To miss a ton of little facts and information, and we might get mixed up. That's okay, though.
Let me one up you, though. We're going to miss big facts as well.
Yeah, like, absolutely.
There's so much to this, and even in the game itself, it is abundantly confusing because you get involved with time travel and different, a lot of stuff that's going on, and so it's unfamiliar from the beginning.
Crazy complex. Yeah, if the entire story of the BioShock series is a giant tree, like, we're going to tap it and maybe get a little bit of maple syrup, but we're not even cutting off branches, probably. That's a good
analogy.
Would
not have gone that direction, but
yeah,
let's get back
on
track.
That's not how my mind thinks, but
I heard the preemptive sigh, Dustin, but it was a good analogy.
I'm not opposed to it. It's just not how most minds think, but I really appreciate the picture that came into my head as you described that.
Yeah,
tapping
and
trees.
And now you also are going to want to eat pancakes, so you're welcome.
Either way, we are going to miss some of those facts and some of the information, but that's okay. There is an extensive wiki, very detailed with like things that I didn't know were in the game, but apparently they're real, and you can read all of it. I encourage you to pull it up while you listen to us and read along with us.
Fact check us.
Yeah, please do.
Don't do that.
Okay, BioShock 1. Clearly the first in the series, my personal favorite, is a very different game for like when it came out. I think that it made a big statement in the way that it told the story because it's just so different and unique. So the story begins with Jack, who is the playable character. You don't really discover his name is Jack until later. But anyways, he's on a plane that crashes over the North Atlantic. And you see this lighthouse and survive by swimming to it. And in that lighthouse, apparently, it's a hub that can take you to this city that is underwater. And that's kind of the whole, I don't want to call it a gimmick, but that's the thing for BioShock 1 is this giant city underwater, which is a really cool idea to start off. Like, I think that's such a brilliant idea, and it's a huge city. It's not like this little dome. It's like, it looks like New York, but underwater.
So specifically, we're talking about Rapture here is the name of that city.
Rapture is the name of the city that Jack gets taken to through a bathysphere, and it goes underwater, and you kind of just see normal wildlife, fishes, rocks, and then out of nowhere, this giant...
You said wildlife, and then you said rocks. I'm sorry.
So dumb, dude.
It was just really funny to me. It's like he was listing wildlife, and there were rocks. I'm sorry, Nolan. Go on.
And then you see this giant city, and you enter it and meet this person named Atlas, who is this mystery guy, but apparently is normal. Compared to the zombies that are everywhere that are like attacking the thing that you came down on. And it's just like this really bad situation down there. Cause at first it looks awesome. It looks like it's populated and looks like a great place to be, but you quickly learn that something terrible has gone wrong down there. Atlas is your guide through this radio, and his wife and child are missing.
And you had mentioned these zombie-like creatures is what they are. They're called splicers, right? That's what you're referencing?
Yes.
These mutated citizens of Rapture that have gone insane, that have been left down there for far too long, probably some kind of limited oxygen thing going on as well, and they're very, very dangerous. And and kind of Atlas is helping you navigate through Rapture to try to avoid and stay alive against all of these splicers that are coming after you.
He's kind of your sanity in all of this. Like, you just crashed and you're kind of in a desperate place, but he is a normal person that's at least got some humanity in him. He's looking for his kids and his kid and his wife. So you help Atlas until you discover that this man named Andrew Ryan, who is apparently the leader of Rapture, the creator of Rapture, actually... kills his wife and kid, and this clearly makes Atlas very angry, so he sends you to find Ryan to kill Ryan. And again, I'm missing a lot of details here, but you eventually find your way to Ryan, and you learn that Atlas is not who he said he was. And in fact, you are dealing with a crazy person who has attempted to overthrow Rapture and done all kinds of terrible, terrible things. One of them being enslaving little girls and sticking bugs in their stomachs to pupate and create this gene, which is another thing. So this is a lot. I promise I'm wrapping up. Adam is this genetic mutation that advances DNA, and they found a way to harness this and to give humans powers like fire in your hand that you can shoot, or electricity in your hand, or like telekinetic powers, which is another mechanic in the game. So you are faced with saving these little girls, helping this scientist named Tenenbaum, and finding Fontaine now that you realize Ryan was not the true evil here, although he was, and you end up defeating him and saving the little girls.
You did much better than I could have done.
That was a great summary for as vast as this story is. Getting through it was good. Is it Thank too you. Late for us to give a spoiler warning now, or is that just going to be obvious because since we're talking about the story?
It's too late, but spoilers.
Yeah, but I think even within that, Nolan did really, really well, and we're going to have to try to do as good to try to navigate somewhat tenderly around these. These are not retro games yet, and so I think we need to be a little bit respectful as we kind of talk.
It's true.
Here.
Whereas normally we kind of say, if you haven't played it by now, if we spoil it, like, it's not our fault. We could have people who haven't played these yet and it not be, out of the realm of possibility that they still want to know the story. So we'll try our best. That wraps up BioShock 1. You're introduced to this world of Rapture. And in BioShock 2, you come back. And once again, you're playing this first-person shooter, but that's in the world of this giant story that's going on. And in this time, you are playing as Subject Delta. Now, Subject Delta is one of the big daddies. I know you had talked about the...
Little mamas?
The counterpart.
Little sisters.
No, it's a weird thing to say. But there's this relationship that happens. These little sisters that are created in the early BioShock need someone to protect them because what's going on is so important with all the, things in their stomach and everything else. And so big daddies are created to protect the little sisters and they're bonded. They're sort of a pair. And that relationship is at the core of a lot of BioShock 2 and what happens. You're playing as Subject Delta, this kind of unknown big daddy who is... It sounds weird saying that every time I say that.
It's not.
Daddy. It's a weird thing to say.
The more you say it, the more comfortable you'll become with it.
Yeah. Okay, just you're right.
Hey, big daddy.
Big daddy, big daddy,
oh,
big
daddy. No.
Big daddy. It works perfectly. And so you start as this big daddy who, early in the story, this won't feel like a spoiler, is forced to kill himself. What? That's true.
I'm just going to throw that out there, though.
Yeah. No, I mean, it's literally like opening sequence. You learn all this. 10 years later, you're somehow alive again, and the connection you have with your little sister, Eleanor, is still intact. And so as the big daddy, you set out to figure out what has happened to Eleanor, and all sorts of bad things have. She is enslaved by her mother, Sophia Lamb, who's kind of the big baddie of this story, and was the one who tried to get you killed in the first place. And you've got to go through a series of trials and tribulations throughout Rapture in order to rescue Eleanor, because Sophia Lamb is trying to turn her into this sort of hive mind, almost, to kind of take the genetic memory, I think is the term that it's used, from everybody that lives in Rapture, and through the Adam stuff, stick all of it into her daughter and make her some kind of embodiment of everything that's good. And it's super villainy kind of stuff that's just whacked out, like everything that happens in this story. And so you got to fight your way all the way through, and then depending how you go along and play the story, you get some kind of ending. But no matter what, well, I don't want to give it away, but
something.
But
happens.
It comes to a resolution, and the story wraps up neatly.
Worth noting that this one was 8 years after the first, so that's 1968 in the game.
Right. I'm sure I missed some really, really big things in there, but that's a very, very broad, but through it all, you go on quite the adventure. That was hard to do.
Not bad.
I didn't nail it nearly as well as Nolan did, but that brings us to the third game in the series that I think is even more challenging to try and summarize, so good luck, Dustin. Tell us what happens.
Grab your popcorn.
BioShock Infinite... begins almost 100 years before either of these games. So in 1874, you've got the birth of a man named Booker DeWitt, who grows up to be a military man and is part of an 1890 Wounded Knee massacre, in which he's the one that is massacring. And He comes to later regret his actions that went on during that war, and wants to become a reformed man, shows up to this baptism, and that baptism scene is central to the plot of BioShock Infinite. Now, fast forward many years, and you're at the start of the actual game itself. BioShock Infinite begins on July 6th, 1912, on Columbia Independence Day. And that's not the Columbia that you might be familiar with. That is a Columbia in the sky. What is a Columbia in the sky, you might ask?
Oh my gosh.
Well, so Rapture, we've been talking about that in BioShock 1 and 2, is central. It's core to the story, to the gameplay, to the narrative, to every single element. And the same is true for the city in the sky, Columbia. There's a lot of history as to how it got there, but basically it was a religious figure, a prophet, who began a cult and moved this new, it started as kind of this Christian community up into this city that was originally above Chicago, and then it kind of did its travel around visiting and hovering above various major cities within the United States before finally floating off high above the clouds into the sky to escape the sin and tyranny of the world below. On Columbia Independence Day, 1912, a brother and sister, kind of, named the Lutesses, they open up a tear into a reality where Booker, the man that I already mentioned, he refused baptism, and in that narrative, he lost his daughter, Anna, and the Lutesses offer a second chance for Booker to reunite with his daughter if he were to follow them. And so he follows them, he steps through the tear, and in doing so, he shows up in Columbia, this place in the sky, and it's in the middle of the celebration, a fair is going on, and here's the thing, though, the prophet had for many years now said that there was this false prophet that was going to show up, and this false prophet would be recognized because he would have the letters AD, the initials AD, written on his hand. Well, Booker has those initials on his hand, so as soon as that is discovered, the whole city turns against Booker, and Booker has to fight his way. He's trying to get to Monument Island, where his daughter is supposed to be. Well, once he gets there, he meets a woman named Elizabeth, who is kind of imprisoned there on Monument Island, convinces her to escape with him so that they can go on this search, realizes that if they have any escape or any chance of escaping, they have to find a zeppelin so they could escape this floating city. Through a series of events, they try to escape, they get struck down. There's this rebellion against the prophet and his people called the Vox Populi, who Booker and Elizabeth find themselves kind of stuck between. They're on neither of the sides, but they're just trying to escape, but they're stuck in this civil war that's going on. And on top of that, Elizabeth has this huge mechanical thing that is actually created from the same kind of construct as the Big Daddies back in Rapture, and it's this songbird. It's this huge mechanical bird who is imprinted on Elizabeth and is her protector. And so that bird, at the same time as the Vox Populi and the Prophet, are trying to keep Elizabeth here while Booker and her are trying to escape. After multiple battles and a series of weird time shifts, Booker finally rescues Elizabeth and confronts the prophet, whose name is Comstock, who's this older man with a huge white beard, white hair, and a lot of reveals take place during these segments, in which Elizabeth finds out stuff about her, and Booker finds out stuff about him, and you find out stuff about the world, and your mind is blown time again, until...
Here's the thing. When you're a series that's already known for complex storytelling and you don't run away from it, instead you kind of embrace it, and not just embrace it, but embrace it by taking on a plot line that depends on like separate narratives of time and alternate realities, and that includes the possibility of time travel with all the other technology and everything else that's going on, you're just going to get a mess of a story, and that's what we run into.
Basically, here. Play the games.
Play the games.
Play the games.
I do want to conclude my narrative section by with somewhat of a spoiler. So once again, skip ahead 1 minute if you don't want to be spoiled. But I think this is key to the story here and just a beautiful connection in that the story of Columbia ends with Booker and Elizabeth walking through a terror to escape Songbird. Oh, and in doing so, ends up in a place called Rapture.
Oh my gosh. I have to replay this game.
It's what's so crazy is that all of this third game happens, which sets up pre-story to the first two. The first two are somewhat related and happening in Rapture and get big, but not nearly as vast as Infinite does. And they're able to make things as complex as they just sounded. If anything, Dustin toned it down in trying to explain some of this story, believe it or not, and yet to still tie it in and I'll make have it make sense within itself and tie back to an original story in a way that's believable is kind of a big feat.
Yeah, it's definitely impressive.
Well, it's a huge feat, but I think that if anyone does it well, it's these creators and these writers, and they do it in such a... It is confusing, but with time travel, right, you're going to be confused. And with games that happen in such different times, as you just mentioned. But if anyone could do it, and if anyone did it well, it's these writers.
Absolutely.
That still,
oh, certainly,
at the end, leave you completely clueless as to what you just experienced.
Right, and we're trying to play, you know, to recap this the story of three really big games that have a lot going on in just a couple of minutes, which is already impossible, but we're trying to do it in a game that, you know, is a first person shooter, and so you're learning these things, but you're learning them gradually, kind of one reveal and one, you know, diary reading and one cutscene and what have you at a time. And so when you're in it playing the games, you get the important parts of the story, even if you miss the minutiae, without it feeling nearly as overwhelming as all of the details we're throwing at you would make it sound. You kind of just go through this, and it's sort of like this is just the world that's happening around you. And so while our explanation feels really heavy-handed, I think living the story by playing the game, all of this is happening in a way that feels really just natural.
Absolutely. And that's the beauty of narrative through video games. You get narrative as you read a book or as you watch a movie, but there's something that's unique that happens. There's many things that are unique that happens in playing a video game story. I think that we're going to kind of address three primary things that stand out to us in the BioShock universe and the BioShock games regarding story and how greatly it impacted us in these games.
Yeah, and so I want to start that off with what is so compelling to me about BioShock 1, but also kind of sticks with each game, and that is the use of mystery that they use to tell the story. So while you're experiencing this game, the plot is hidden. All these details we've discussed are not explained. You're just like, you just lived this, or you survived this like plane crash, and then it's like, this is where you're going. And then from there, you are introduced to danger and to like magic, almost like with the plasmids and the electricity in your hand and the impending danger and like what your goal is all at once. And the way they do it is with these like what are they called? And they're called something different in BioShock Infinite, but in Rapture you find these little like holotapes. That's Fallout. But they're recordings of some of the residents that were in Rapture, which were very important and powerful people. So like Andrew Ryan's idea was the most brilliant people would come to Rapture. So brilliant scientists and doctors and artists would come to Rapture, and this would be like their safe haven where they can, you know, there's no limits on your research on what you can do. And so those figureheads like recorded themselves as things started to get crazy down there, and you pick them up and you can listen to them while playing the game, and you get little bits of information, but never too much that you can piece it together. You just kind of hear here and there like something going on, and like the shrouded mystery that is over everything is what drew me in and kept me there.
It's so easy to do that really badly. Like, so many stories will do that, will supplement what's going on in the big story, the things you can't see, you know, with a cutscene or narrative or action happening in front of you if you're Max Payne or whatever. And they'll do it by literally having you pick up a diary or something. And so many times I roll my eyes because I'm like, ugh, great, here, just tell me the story. You know, I should have just read the wiki from the beginning. What a lame way of telling me. But they're so tactful about it here, in terms of giving you, you know, little quotations and just little hints of what's going on, and it, like, tantalizing you, and it, they're actually intriguing, and they do, they build mystery and unveil things, but not in, like, a cheesy kind of way. And I think sometimes when games go to story and use that mechanic, they lean on it as a crutch, and I don't think they did that here.
In Infinite, it's through the collection of voxophones. You've got you've got 85 voxophones in all, and they slowly reveal more of the backstory, and they're narrated by the characters in BioShock Infinite, the characters that are existing now or that were pre-existing before the game, the events in the game actually began, and it just slowly slowly reveals the world. This is what I appreciate. In some video games, you just find little tomes that are just text-based that kind of just tell you what it had. But is what you're doing in this game in particular, in all three of these games, is you're slowly discovering the world, but not, it's not just being spoon-fed to you. It's through this art of narrative and through this art of drama that it's being slowly revealed to you how in BioShock, it's how creepy and messed up this society actually was. And in Infinite, it's how kind of time travel and these tears and how the Columbia even came to be. So it's very interesting how the mystery is slowly peeled away so that you can see more and more throughout the game, until in each of these games, that final 30 minutes or so in which everything just falls down around you and you're like, what just happened?
And it's
what?
Like, read it to me. Don't, like, yeah. They have, like, these really great voice actors that capture that character, even though they're not, like, a main character, like a Russian doctor or something. It's just, like, great, and you can listen to them while you play, and it's almost like a reward because you've been scouring and, like, looking through the levels and trying out each little hallway you find, and you may see a scene where you're like, what happened in this room? There's blood all over a doctor's chair. Like, what happened? And then you'll find a recording later that is the doctor that was in that room, and you can hear what happened. And it's like that, it just encourages exploration and just further deep dive into the world around you.
It's probably worth noting, and if you're not familiar with the series at all, maybe it just became obvious in what Nolan said, but these are kind of dark games. As a first-person shooter, they get a little bit violent and stuff goes a little bit crazy. Nothing like absolutely unbearable, but if you go into it just expecting a jolly story because of how we've told things, you're going to get a pretty stark reality slapping you in the face before too long.
Yeah, it's PG-18 for sure.
Yeah, absolutely. I think that's a good way of kind of summarizing what you're getting into. So I agree, Nolan. They do that so well. The thing that I love about how they go about telling story through the BioShock series that I think sticks out to me as something really important is how even in a, like, far-fetched, fantastic alternate reality that they're kind of setting up, how much they lean on themes and kind of known entities to their audience. When you look at the kind of stuff they're talking about in each of these games thematically, you know, collectivism, exceptionalism, the way religion interacts with society and the role of the individual, the way race interacts with people and stuff goes on. These are thematic themes that are like echoing what's going on. And you can even see from game to game what's going on in society at the moment. And it doesn't just stop there. They make references to literature and everything from overt references in some of the early works to, you know, to later some of the stuff that goes on with the prophet. And they tell a creative fake story, but they tell, even though it's far-fetched, a human story because they're drawing on human experience. And that's so, so big. And I think any fantastic far-fetched story that doesn't do that will feel hollow to us. But even if you go as weird as you possibly can, if your characters are human and the struggles of society are human struggles, and if you give your audience a connecting point from this fake reality to your own with something that they know, with references that they know, with things that are familiar, suddenly the far-fetched doesn't seem quite as far-fetched. And I think BioShock strikes that balance perfectly. They deal with themes that matter to people, but they do it creatively, and they do it in a way that is sort of disarming, and you can ask those questions. You know, what does it mean when you have a society that, you know, that doesn't have a working class, or that is so separated that everybody thinks they're the most important? And, you know, just all of these deep kinds of questions, and that's in the middle of a shooter. It's just, yes. It's wild.
But while there's depth there, there's also a lot of levity too. So in Infinite, it's done beautifully. And at first, it doesn't make any sense. It's completely anachronistic, in which you've got this barbershop quartet as soon as you show up to, as soon as you show up to Columbia, and they are singing these renditions of songs from like the Beach Boys and Girls Just Want to Have Fun by Cyndi Lauper and all of these songs that we're familiar with, and it's so beautifully done and that you don't recognize it at first, but then after a moment or two, you're like, hold on, I've heard this before. And then you start to realize that they've just done it. So you're thinking at first, maybe this is just a creative design decision of the video game creators. But as the story unfolds, you realize why this is taking place. And the reality behind
brilliant.
That there were these tears in the fabric of time or reality so that you could... And this is all deep into the narrative so that you could see into and get traces and glimpses of other realities or other could-bes. And so what has happened is some of these people in this era and in this time have looked through these tears, heard some of these songs, and recreated them in their era in the early 1900s. And so it makes sense in this context. And it's just some beautiful references to the real world for us.
And they don't just drop those cool references, which is great, and they drop it in terms of big storyline. Dustin, you talked about the diverging of two major storylines, two basically alternate realities that split, and they do that right at this baptism scene, which is such a like visual that people cling to and see in movies and in their real life and experience and know as something that can be sort of personally defining for people. And they let that be a moment that kind of changes everything into these two different worlds that are running simultaneously. And it's familiar, it's known, it feels important, and yet it feels natural. And they kind of jumble all that stuff up just so creatively, and yet it never feels forced, which is hard when you're messing with the whole time travel alternate timelines take on things. So hard to do that.
And it gets kind of deep, but like in BioShock 1, they do a great job of just showing how evil humanity can be. Like humans are at very important parts of their lives. Like even the good people in the story. So like Tenenbaum is an example. She's the scientist that you meet that is trying to save the little sisters, but you uncover like some of her past in the research and how it came about and the bribe she took from Fontaine, this evil dude to fund her research. And they play on that throughout the series too, which a lot of games don't really take the time to do. It's such a quality that I didn't know I was missing in games, but in storytelling games, I love that emotional pull that they put on every situation and on the characters.
Yeah. They've got a spectrum of morality that's more than just black and white, which is, I think, more realistic always.
Speaking of morality and black and white, they don't shy away from racism. It's early 1900s, yeah. So what do you expect? And that plays a huge factor in the story of Infinite specifically. With Rapture, it's more, goodness, the culture there,
society,
with all the artists and stuff. It is,
yeah, more the class division. And
Infinite, it's literally, they've brought on... African Americans to be the workers there in the beginning, and the kind of the lady that is leading the Vox Populi, the revolt, is a black woman, and so and that's not just coincidental. That plays a huge factor there, which is obviously very culturally relevant, even sadly in our day and age today.
Oh, absolutely. Yeah.
And the fact that you're finding that in a video game is super important. These games were very important, and they're so good.
Right. And then they do stuff like, say, if you're dying of cancer, they don't say this, they present it through a really creative story, but they do things like, say, if you're dying of cancer, would you rather get half of your body chopped off and be replaced by a robot and keep being able to be alive, or would you rather not have a life? And like, they just answer these sort of fundamentally messy questions, but they do it, I don't even know if they provide answers, but they let those realities and those conflicts exist, and it's cool to see how they approach it, and I think that's some excellent storytelling.
And then the story component that I find super intriguing is just this slow unmasking and revealing of huge plot twists or reveals that you don't know at first. You think one thing, and then they pull the rug out from under you, and it's a completely different thing. This happens in all three of the stories. It's one of I think the writer's favorite things to do. But they would do that regularly with Infinite in particular, in that they would set up, hey, this is what you should believe, and then they would flip that on its head, and not in that can be done in a very distasteful way of like,
yeah, it can be cheap if you don't set it up, if you don't invest in it, whatever.
It could be done really cheap, but as you guys mentioned earlier, they dove in with this one head first. And so like it's not just a light thing here or there. It's not just an easy way out. They built the entire world knowing these realities, and so that there's clues along the way that you might start having some questions. So without getting into specifics, you might have some questions as to how the Lutece twins, brother and sister, are related and how their relation is to the world. You're going to have questions as to how Booker plays into all of this and how his memory is not working. Why does he keep having these headaches and these nosebleeds? What's going on with that, and what does that mean? You're going to have these questions as to how Comstock gained the power that he did to be able to create the city that floats. You're going to have all of these questions, even as what we've already mentioned, of how this technology exists in the early 1900s and how this music exists in the early 1900s. All of these things, however, have answers, and that's one of the beautiful things about it.
And I'm usually good at like seeing where they're going with it, and I'm like, I can call it usually. And I guess that's what you meant by like a distasteful way or just an obvious way. Every single time I was definitely tripped up by it. Like, they blew me away every single time.
And they're big, but they make sense. They've set them up, and so it's to me, it's like the game writers found M. Night Shyamalan's more talented younger brother, threw him in a conference room with him and gave him a bunch of meth and told him, just go to town. Because it's twist upon twist, but it's not hokey twists. It's twists done well and that make sense and that fit into the story. And I don't know. I'm with you, Dustin. I think it's totally something that they just absolutely dominate in this storytelling shooter that they have.
And what's so impressive to me about all of it when it comes together is that if you take Bioshock 1, and at the time when it came out, I don't think anyone was thinking at all that this was going to be a very story-heavy game or even have emphasis on the story. Oh, it's a cool, edgy setting. It's a very dark shooter. It's a first-person shooter, big deal. But they bring it full circle with Infinite and make Rapture have a purpose and why it happened and like the possibilities behind Rapture and the characters. I love Bioshock by itself, but I appreciate it so much more that they took the care and all of it was intentional, with the end goal being this like grand, grand plot. They're so dark and bad even at times. I mean like gritty and bloody, but it's just a beautiful story that they connected at the end of the day.
Bioshock 1, 2, and Infinite are truly unique games. There's so many elements, characteristics, qualities about these games that are appealing, and it's why the series was so successful. But I think we can all agree that one of the most impactful, profound, and lasting elements of this incredible series is the way in which the story is unveiled and told. There's enough there just for the casual gamer, but for those that are willing to delve into it deeply, read every single piece that they can find and listen to every single recording that they can find and really take in all the story that is being revealed throughout these games, then they're in for an incredible journey as they go through the story of BioShock.
Oh, absolutely. And we only scratched the surface, even in terms of some of the things that make story being told well such an experience here. These people, you can tell, put care and time and wanted to not just create a video game, but to create an experience that was beautiful, even though it's, like Nolan said, warned, shared, a dark and gritty kind of story. And so... it's one that if you haven't played, we thought it was worth talking, worth knowing about enough to talk about. And so we say, hey, pick it up, check it out. We think that you'd love this story.
And thank you for taking the time to listen to this special Elements episode. This really is an excursion from what we do on a regular basis. We usually get together each and every week and we play a retro video game and then we come and we talk about it, the good, the bad, and the ugly. It's not what we're doing in these Elements episodes. So thank you for giving us the time to play some other games, to explore some other themes, and really do a deep dive on certain elements of video games. It's one of our favorite things to do as a part of this podcast now. And it is all... thanks to our patrons. We mentioned this at the top of the episode, but we definitely want to give a special shout out to our producers, Bradley, Zion, and Gimbarino, for their support above and beyond just to keep this podcast going and to help us do what we do. We really appreciate you three and everyone else that supports us on Patreon. Until next time, I'm still Dustin.
I'm Kenny.
I'm Nolan.
And this has been another bonus episode of New Game Plus.